Welcome back to another episode of Foolproof Theology. My name is Chase Davis, and I am your host. It's good to be with you here again today. We're going to talk about something that I've been looking into for several years now, many years now, and that is the topic of Bitcoin. I have on the episode today Jordan Bush. He is connected with Thank God for Bitcoin, wrote a book. He was telling me off air it outsold the Pope when the Pope released his book, so he's a good Protestant man trying
Take
to that, do
Bishop
that.
Take that, Bishop of Rome.
Take that, Bishop of Rome. So, Jordan, thank you so much for spending some time with me today to talk about this topic.
Sure. Chase, thanks for having me on.
So are you the founder of Thank God for Bitcoin then?
Yeah. So I'm the founder, one of the founders of TGFB Media. Basically, our tagline is, we exist to help the church understand and use Bitcoin for the glory of God and the good of people everywhere. Which, if you know nothing about Bitcoin, that might sound preposterous. But I look forward to kind of unpacking, why that's not a heretical or insane thing to say.
Sure. Excellent. Well, let's work our way to that topic then. Because from what I understand, you were part of a church plant or you were a church planner. You have some background in ministry. So give me some more background on that. Where were you planting? What was that like?
Yeah. So my wife and I met at Bible college. We ended up getting married with the understanding that we wanted to be missionaries. We were initially anticipating going to, one of the places in the world where they have no scripture, no Bible translated into their language. And so we were anticipating going to a jungle tribe and being missionaries in that context. And in the Lord's providence and sense of humor, he sent us to an urban jungle, we ended up going to Montevideo, Uruguay, for the Spanish speakers out there. So we were there from 2015 to the end of 2021, helped plant a church there, helped pastor for 2 years when some of the leadership dynamics changed of our team. It was a Reformed Baptist church plant. And so then near the last 2 years, we ended up merging with a small church plant that was sent out by, ironic in light of recent events, but Alistair Begg's church, fantastic, team that kind of moved down there. And so we ended up merging churches with them the week before COVID hit Uruguay.
Wow.
And so we got to see incredibly our church, there were lots of churches who were shutting down and stayed closed, and our church stayed open and continued to grow throughout the 2 years of COVID. So, so the Lord was really kind. And so, that's kind of my background.
That's excellent. And so you were in Uruguay for about 6 years. When COVID hit down there, were similar policies implemented as the States?
So in the case of Uruguay, a lot of the demographic details ended up resulting that it was a little bit different. So there are no native Uruguayans. There were a small group of indigenous people a couple hundred years ago, but they were literally rounded up and exterminated by, I think it was the Spanish settlers at that point. And so the people who live in Uruguay are largely of either Spanish or Italian descent. And so, Chase, you could be Uruguayan. I could be Uruguayan. You can't tell by looking at someone's skin whether or not they're Uruguayan. They can look very European and normal and white. And then there are people who have darker skin and stuff like that. But then also culturally, it's much more similar to Europe. 50% of the population of Uruguay claims to be atheist or agnostic. And so it's not like going to Mexico or something. It's very, very different. So because of the connection to Europe, if you guys remember, one of the first places that got hit by COVID where there was a lot of deaths was this old folks home in Italy. And so a lot of people in Uruguay have family and friends who are in Italy. And so when they saw that, everybody just kind of self-quarantined. They just completely shut down. So there wasn't the need for the type of need. There wasn't the type of government response, that you saw in the States and some other places, just because the people themselves did it automatically.
Okay. That makes sense. And then as far as your background in ministry, you said you went to Bible college. Where did you go to Bible college?
Yeah. So back before they weren't ashamed of the gospel. It was called Baptist Bible College. No, I'm joking. A lot of these Bible colleges, in order to send people into different places around the world, they kind of change their name so they're not as explicit about the Bible. So I believe it's called Clark Summit University. It's in the same or very close to where The Office was filmed fictionally in Pennsylvania. So
that's awesome. So is that a IFB college or just an independent non-denominational college? What is that?
It's aligned with, ABWE, I think is the missions arm.
I've had a guy on from their ministry.
Cool.
Alex Kochman.
Okay.
I've had him on the show. So that's great. Okay, cool. And now you're back in the States. When you came back, did you want to go back into ministry or did you just go straight into Bitcoin?
Yeah, so we had written the book beginning of 2021 was when it published. I'm somebody who I'm a Bible nerd. I mean, I didn't do secondary education, but have done a ton of reading and working and trying to understand these things. So reading guys like, you know, James B. Jordan, Peter Lehar, I mean, just like going deep dive on, you know, a lot of these things. And it's always interested me. So when I started going down the Presbyterian rabbit hole, I started just trying to make sense of these things. And once I got to the point where they made sense, and where I realized that we were going to have to leave all of our supporting churches, and, you know, we didn't necessarily have to leave the ministry that we were involved in. We, you know, they were open to us returning in a different capacity. But when I got to the point where I realized, man, I understand this pretty central doctrine of Christianity differently, the prospect of just turning and jumping right into ministry just didn't make sense to me. I just was like, you know, here I am. I'd be starting again and saying to people, admitting to people, I had this gaping hole in my understanding of the scriptures that isn't just tangential. And now I believe something differently. Here, guys, follow me. You know, it just didn't make sense to me. In the intervening time, I found that there's been people who, you know, moved from Baptist to Presbyterian and, you know, they've, you know, rather quickly moved into ministry. And again, I don't, you know, look down on them or anything. It's just their different situations. But in my case, it didn't seem like it made sense, or I felt comfortable asking people to follow me with the recency of that change. So I came back to the States, started looking for at least a job that I could do in the meantime as I figured things out in the ministry side. And so it just so happened that some of the other guys who I'd written this book, Thank God for Bitcoin, with, they were either had been in Bitcoin since 2011, buying Bitcoin at less than $10 a coin, or had been founders of different companies and, you know, became independently wealthy. So, I came back, put on a 1-day event, in Miami ahead of the largest Bitcoin conference in the world, invited a whole bunch of people. And we had probably 175 people show up with 6 weeks anticipation to come to this event. And in the aftermath of that, we had, I mean, a lot of success. We had just crazy people show up, like Tim Tebow randomly showed up and just like came and like all these different politicians who are involved in, you know, who are Christians and involved in different things. And so in the aftermath of that, some of these other authors came to me and said, hey, you know, you clearly care about this issue. You care about, you know, Christians understanding this issue and are able to do this. If you're willing to do this, we'd be happy to fund it. And so they gave us a couple year runway of funding to be able to work on this full time. And so that's what I've been doing for the last year and a half.
Excellent. Well, it's funny, you know, I'll get messages from listeners and sometimes the messages are, how did you get that person? Or how did you find that person to get them on your podcast? And my answer is pretty much always the same. I messaged him and invited them on my show. There's not like some secret club. It's just like Jordan followed me on Twitter. I followed him on Twitter. And then I kept seeing him talk about this stuff. And I kept getting bombarded by Bitcoin bots. Yeah, I don't know if you get that. And I was like, I need somebody to come on and explain this. And Jordan has a unique task today because there's certain things in life I've failed to understand. One of those is like chemistry in college. That was like one of the hardest subjects for me. Maybe it was the teacher. I don't know. Chemistry in seminary was Greek. Greek like killed me. I couldn't. Yep. I passed. Thank God. But it just was really challenging to learn that while I was planting a church. Another is why people like In-N-Out and why people prefer In-N-Out. I don't understand.
Amen. Truly an abomination, In-N-Out. I just don't even understand.
Half the people have now signed off this conversation.
Good riddance.
And then the next one is Bitcoin. And I've listened to multiple people talk about it. I've watched YouTube videos on it. I own Bitcoin. I still don't understand it. I've watched videos of people mining Bitcoin in like Mongolia. And I'm like, I still don't understand. They're talking about mining and they have this massive thing with computers and I don't know what's happening. And so Jordan has to explain to me Bitcoin to someone who is coming at this very humbly, but also like, is this a joke? Like, is this just monopoly money? And so that's what I want to do. The way I think is I want to start with like the big picture of money from a biblical perspective. And I want to get into that and I want to work our way down to Bitcoin, because I think that may help me more than like getting on YouTube and going on there and being like, what is Bitcoin? And then you've got like a 2-minute clip and I'm like, I don't really get it. It's not a thing. So let's start with money, the ethics of money production. What can we learn there?
Yeah. So this issue of the ethics of money production has been like the gateway drug for me getting into this issue. And again, there's a number of reasons for that. I'll start with the most practical. So when we moved to Uruguay, we anticipated planting a church among this very, you know, post-Christian secular, you know, people. We get there and we arrive in 2015 at the same time as this wave of at least 60,000 Venezuelan immigrants are piling into Uruguay, piling into Colombia and Brazil and several different other countries. And so I had no framework. I did not know why this was happening. And so as we're just trying to get set up and established in Uruguay, we have young kids, we're trying to get them in school and stuff. We're also trying to help these Venezuelan immigrants just start their lives over. And so as we're talking to these people, the majority of them are men who've left their wives and kids back in Venezuela to try to move to another country, get a job, send money home, and then eventually save up to bring them to Uruguay in this case. So we're just trying to help them, you know, just get basic furniture and, you know, get basic foodstuffs because they don't have anything. I'm trying to understand their situations. And so in some of these cases, these people were doctors, economists. I mean, people who were literally a few years prior to this making $100,000 a year denominated in dollars in Venezuela. And now 3 or 4 years later, they can't even pay the rent in Uruguay. And so as we're just ministering to their souls and trying to, you know, help them get established, I'm sitting there, me, the Bible and philosophy major, thinking something doesn't add up here. I don't understand why this is happening. And so then I start to understand that, you know, part of the reason why this is happening is because the government of Venezuela had hyperinflated the currency. And basically what that looks like is the government, in order to get elected, one of the downsides of you know, democracy is, you know, the temptation is for incoming politicians to ensure they're winning in elections by promising free stuff. And the way that most politicians, it's the quickest and easiest way to provide that free stuff is just to print the money. Because we live in a world in which everyone's currency is what's called fiat currencies. It's not backed by anything. Or it's not backed by any kind of scarce resource. It's backed by the threat of violence, you know, via the military or, you know, different things. So, so again, I'm trying to understand that. And as I'm going down that rabbit hole, I find that what the situation that was happening in Venezuela wasn't new. It actually happened 3 times prior to that since 1971, which was the year that the United States basically went off of the gold standard. And so, again, I also found that this had happened in almost every country in Latin America at least 3 times since that same period. So on average, every 14 to 15 years, you know, 15, 16 years, you know, these basically these currencies are failing. And so I, again, over the course of a few years, started to try to understand why that had happened. And so I found that, you know, in 1971, in post-World War II, the post-World War II world, you know, Europe had barely survived. They had, you know, been able to survive. They'd spent almost all of their gold just surviving. They had paid countries like the United States for guns and ammo and weapons, food. They'd also paid countries like Uruguay. Uruguay was on the Allied side, and their biggest economic boom came in the aftermath of World War II based on all the money they made. So in the aftermath of World War II, Europe, many of the countries in Europe don't have gold. So the question is, what are we going to use as money now? And so they did this event, this conference. It's called the Bretton Woods Conference in Bretton Woods, New Hampshire. And a bunch of the countries from around the world come together and they're going to have this big discussion of what currency we're going to use. Now, the United States had received the lion's share of this gold because of their geographical isolation. And so they have the majority of the leverage. And so they basically say, hey, here's what we think we should do. We think that we, the global community here, should peg gold to the US dollar. And so then you countries in Europe and you countries around the world can hold US dollar reserves instead of gold reserves. We'll fix the ratio. And then you can peg your own currencies to these dollar reserves. And then it'll be a, you know, similar situation to what we had before. And we promise, pinky swear, that we won't, you know, hyperinflate the currency. We'll maintain our word of keeping this ratio between the currencies. So that goes on for, you know, 20 some odd years. And in 1971, one of these countries, I never remember, it's either France or Germany, comes to the United States, and they had this convertibility deal. You know, one of the checks on this was the convertibility. So they could come to, countries could come to the United States and say, hey, we want to exchange some of our dollar reserves for gold. And the day that this happened in 1971, the very next day, President Nixon, everyone's favorite president, comes out and says, the United States is stopping the convertibility of gold for U.S. dollars. And so in that day, you know, that doesn't sound like that big of a deal. He just makes this pronouncement. But really what the United States was announcing that day was they were declaring bankruptcy on the agreement that they had made to, you know, to honor this exchange of gold for dollars. And what everyone found out in the aftermath of this was that the United States had been abusing it's called the absorbent privilege. They were abusing the privilege of being the only currency that can legally reproduce the reserve currency. They'd been producing much more of it than they said they were. They hadn't been maintaining that ratio of a certain amount of dollars to gold, and they'd been leveraging that for their own political expediency. And so the day this happens, what it does is it throws every other nation in the world that had been abiding by that agreement into free fall. You can think about it like, you know, you can imagine a guy on the ground holding a balloon. He's got the string that's tethering the balloon to the ground. And if you cut that string, all of a sudden that balloon goes off into free fall, you know, into free flight. And so basically at that point, every currency around the world was only as strong as its government was fiscally responsible. And if you know anything about human nature and governments, you know that that is not going to go well for very long. So that was the reason why, you know, what I was seeing and our Venezuelan brothers and sisters were experiencing was happening. And so, again, that was really interesting for me. And again, I started to see this isn't just some pie in the sky, you know, philosophical thing that has nothing to do with everybody's, you know, everyday life. It actually had everything to do with their everyday life. And so, again, it was easy to look at Venezuela and see, you know, this is the worst of this is the tail end of the situation. But I looked around at my brothers and sisters in Uruguay and the state of the church in Uruguay. There's very few churches that could afford to pay their pastors anything approaching a living wage. Most of them are working at least one other job and many times two. Very few churches can afford to buy buildings. And the reason for that goes back to the currency devaluations thing. Imagine you're a church planter, Chase. You plant a church in Uruguay and you know you save. Your church is incredibly generous. You guys are giving. Real estate prices are continuing to increase, but they're being, you know, they're dying to self. They're saving. They're producing more than they're consuming. You guys save for 10 years. You guys have saved up, let's say a building costs $500,000. You guys have saved up $400,000. And during the intervening that, you know, right as you're in between this period to be able to save up enough, the currency collapses. And that money that you've been saving becomes literally worthless within the span of a few months. And so that's the situation that had been happening over and over and over again throughout Latin America and in other countries around the world. And so, again, I just started to see this as a, you know, this is something that is affecting the, you know, the ability of the church to have independent functioning churches that aren't constantly needing to have their hand out to places like the United States and Europe. And so again, the more that I started to kind of think about these things, the more I saw this isn't just some completely unrelated thing to ministry and to the lives of normal people. It's actually having a huge impact on their lives and you know, their attempts to live and minister to people around the world.
Okay, so let's get into a little bit. And if you say this is not something I'm very familiar with, totally fine, we can move on. Yeah. And I can just clip this question out. But with monetary policy, because I really appreciate the historical context, I want to go even further if we can.
Yeah.
Because, you know, even as a kid, kids trying to understand money, I mean, they can understand addition and subtraction. And and then you get into like middle school and high school and they talk about, you know, interest rates and compound interest and all this kind of stuff. But even then, we're still giving, when I give my children a dollar, you know, I try to explain the value of it. It's odd, you know, and because I'm a history kind of nerd and I'm from Texas, I was showing them, you know, some, antique, we picked them up at the Alamo, I think, when I was a kid, some antique bills from the Republic of Texas, right? And so I've been fascinated by currency as a thing. Like, when did humans create currency in place of exchanging resources. Because when you read books as a kid, you hear about money bags with you know, gold or silver, whatever it may be. And so are you familiar with kind of history of currency in terms of like when it became a normal thing that everybody had a piece of paper that represented some standard?
Yeah. And this is a fascinating question. So again, we all have this intuitive thing. All of us have, we have different things that are intuitional that aren't necessarily true. And one of the things that I found that is this intuition that we have is that, you know, is we believe that there was a point in which we didn't have something that served as money. We just did exchange resources. And again, that makes sense because you're like, well, you know, we've got food and then we can exchange it for this thing. But honestly, we don't have a historical record of there being a point at which there wasn't something that served as a type of money, or that something that served as a type of ledger system to keep track of exchanges. And so, I mean, from a biblical standpoint, you know, we read, when one of the first things you read when you start reading the book of Genesis is, and again, this is obviously written after the fact, but you see that, you know, Moses mentions that there's the land of Havilah where all the good gold was. He starts mentioning gold, like right from the beginning of the scripture. I believe it's, you know, chapter two or three. So it's right there from the beginning. You see gold being talked about. The question is, what does money do? What kind of role does it serve? And really the problem that money exists to solve is this problem of the coincidence of wants, is the fancy way to say it. So now, if you know, Chase, let's say I'm an orange farmer and you're a pastor. Okay, I want to tithe. You know, every month I'm going to tithe to you in what I have. I have oranges, so I can tithe oranges to you. Now, you will be grateful for that. The problem is if there's another orange farmer within your congregation, and yeah. So then you're like, hey guys, like I appreciate, you know, the fruit of your labor here, pun intended, but there's only so much need that I have for oranges. And so then there can be a couple of things that can happen. You can either then have to become an orange broker and try to go around and find people who need these oranges that you have an overabundance of. Or, you know, and again, this isn't something that people sit down and do. Or you can have something that serves as this third thing, this intermediary that can be this thing that is valuable to everyone, or that kind of is a stand-in that people can trade in lieu of directly trading the actual work that, you know, the fruits of the work that they're doing. And so that's kind of where money has come in. Now, the question is why gold? Why, you know, what are some of the reasons for that gold has served as money for much of human history? It's got to do with the properties of gold. There's a number of properties that make up good money. Historically, gold has been chosen to be money because it's got certain characteristics. There's certain you know, characteristics and principles that it has that make it valuable and good as money. There's different numbers of these characteristics that people describe. Some of them have more than this, some have less. But this is a general. These five are generally agreed on. The first one is durability. If you're going to be using something as money, you want it to be durable. This is why something like bananas or oranges don't make good money. There's a shelf life to them, or a vine life, or a tree life to them. So that's one thing. Durable. If you're gonna have money, you want it to be durable. Another thing is portability. You want to be able to move it from one place to another. That's, you know, pretty obvious. Divisibility. You need something that can be broken down into larger or smaller pieces, depending on the thing that you're using it to purchase. You know, if you're going to buy a house, you know, you might need one level of thing. If you're going to, you know, if you're going to buy, you know, a banana, you're going to want something that's a lot smaller than that. Recognizability. How do you determine that this thing that you're using as money actually is the thing that it says it is, and not, you know, fool's gold or whatever, or, you know, it's not something, it's just a counterfeit. And then the last one would be scarcity. So this is the reason why we don't use something like sand as money, because there's no need to go out and work to produce sand in most circumstances. You can just, you know, if you could just go out and scoop some up and then go trade it for things that are scarce and that do require actual expenditure of time and effort and energy and labor to produce. And so again, this is a big deal. I would say if you up to this point, you've kind of been following this and you're like, okay, I'm a Bible person. Please help. Send help. This is where, to put this in biblical parlance, one of the issues that is shaping what serves as money is the principle of sowing and reaping. When I was in Uruguay, I was doing sermon prep one day. I'd been thinking about Bitcoin for probably 8 months. And I read Galatians 6, where the Apostle Paul says, God is not mocked, for what a man sows, that will he also reap. And so again, I was trying to reflect on that and trying to figure out, okay, what is he saying? And I just realized, okay, so Paul is saying that this principle of sowing and reaping is so hardwired into the fabric of the universe that to deny it is tantamount to mocking God. And so then I started to try to think about, what are some other examples of this? And one of the things that came to mind was in the book of Thessalonians, Paul says, if one is not willing to work, then neither should he eat. He's saying there's a fixed relationship. There should be a relationship between working and eating, because the point of eating, the telos of eating, is to give you energy to work, give you energy to go out and serve other people's needs, to love your neighbor and to honor God by submitting to his leadership, his rule. So another one of these is, we have within sin, the relationship between sin and works is God will render to each one according to his works. So there's a one-to-one relationship between your works that you do and the way that God repays you. Logic itself is founded upon sowing and reaping. And so we see this principle everywhere. You could just keep going on. This principle is everywhere. And the reality is that this same principle that governs every other part of our lives also ought to govern money. And the cost of that not happening is the same cost that Paul talked about in the book of Galatians, is that we mock God. Because when you have a money that has no cost of production, what it allows governments and central banks to do is to create their own world. It allows them to say, let my kingdom come and let my will be done and let me subsidize and fund anything, any crazy thing that I want to see happen in the world. So scarce money forces people to adapt to it. It forces people to make choices, this and not this. It forces people to choose fiat currencies that are able to be created ad infinitum, easily without much effort, enables governments and central banks to shortcut that reality. In reality, you cannot shortcut. You can't mock God. God won't be mocked. And these things just end up collapsing in the end, the way that they ended up collapsing in Venezuela and Uruguay. But those are principles that kind of make up money. It should be this scarce thing, by which we denominate everything else scarce in our life.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So then, when I study some of this stuff, some topics come up, and you've mentioned several of them: central banks and fiat currency. When we say fiat currency, what do we mean by fiat currency?
Yeah. So the phrase that most Christians will be most familiar with is, are you familiar with the phrase fiat lux?
No, I'm actually not.
Okay. What is it? Right. So fiat lux is like Latin for, it means let there be light. So the first time we hear let there be light, it's God speaking. And so God is the only one in the biblical, in the world we live in, God is the only person who can create ex nihilo. He's the only person who can create out of nothing. The identity, when God creates people, he creates us to be stewards. So we move around and take the resources and energy and thoughts that God gives us, and we seek to shape them and use them for God's designed means or for his designed purposes. But we don't create out of thin air. It just doesn't happen. The Apostle Paul says, "What do you have that you did not receive?" And the answer to that question is nothing. Everything we have is stuff that we've received. But fiat currencies are currencies that are created out of thin air. And honestly, the way that they're created is primarily through the issuance of new debt. And so again, Christians ought to have an issue with debt. There's so many warnings and prohibitions of the dangers of debt. But I'll give you an example of this. So 100 years ago, if you were going to get a mortgage to build a house, what you had is you had what was called reserve banking. So people who had money, they have gold or silver money, they would deposit that in a bank account. And then if somebody wanted a mortgage or something, they would have to, the bank would lend them out money that was made up of some of its deposits, And then they would charge a cost of interest for that. What's the price for getting access to this money that you didn't do work to earn? And so the interest rates were higher. Now, the way that it works is, ever since that link between the gold standards was lost, or, you know, having a currency that was backed by something was lost, is now the way that mortgages happen is, when you go down to the bank to try to take out a mortgage, the amount of money that they give you has nothing to do with the amount of reserves in the bank. They issue you a mortgage that is a future facing debt that you have to pay back. So rather than being, hey, this is the fruit of work that has been done in the past, you're promising to do work into the future to pay that debt back. And so effectively, this is the primary way that money is created. A lot of us have probably seen the memes of the money printer, you know, with the money printer go burr. And we think that the Treasury, the U.S. Treasury and Jerome Powell and these guys, you know, the Federal Reserve, that they're creating a lot of the money. The reality is that they create some of it, but a lot of it is just created through private banks, through the issuance of new debt for houses or business loans or whatever they are. And so that's what fiat currencies are. It's money that doesn't have a backing, that whose value is arbitrarily issued to the bill. So again, it takes more or less the same ink and amount of paper to create a $1 bill as it does a $100 bill. And right. So that doesn't make sense. That doesn't jive with how everything else in life works.
Okay. So then the issue of central banks, you know, cause you'll hear some people talk about ending the Fed or something like that. Yeah. And, you know, it's funny. I think I get it. Just intuitively, but at the same time, if you could explain it a little bit, like how do the central banks control currency, interest rates, that kind of thing?
Yeah, exactly. It's a fantastic question. So again, this, and as people who don't have familiarity with these kind of things, the best thing to do is just kind of go back to the history. So the question is, where did central banks come from? We've had banks for a long time. Jesus actually, in the parable of the talents, he says, you know, to the last guy, the unfaithful servant, he's like, why didn't you, rather than bury the talent, why didn't you just go give it to the bankers? And then they could give me interest on my money. So banks have been around for a really long time. The difference between banks and central banks is the difference between, the government governing a town or something like that in a international or a national government or something along those lines. There's a huge difference. And so central banks in the United States came about because there were normal banks that didn't like the competition that they were getting from these upstart banks. There was this period of time, there was this movement called the wildcat banking era. And so you had new people moving into the banking industry and starting up banks all over the place. And so this introduced competition, which lowered margins and lowered prices and stuff like that. And so a number of these bigger existing bankers did is they went to politicians and they colluded with them to, you know, create these super banks that then could give them an advantage over their upstart competition. And so this is kind of, you know, where this issue happened. So that happened in 1913, the creation of the Federal Reserve. It was created to be this super bank that then could change the interest rates of money to serve the interests of the you know, politicians and bankers, basically. So again, there are all kinds of, that wasn't their stated justification. They're not standing at the podium twisting their mustaches. here's what we're doing. But that's the reality of what they were doing. Central banking gives these bankers and politicians the ability to, you know, effectively change the cost of capital, manipulate the dynamics of sowing and reaping to work in their favor, and so that they can take a cut out of it. And so, again, a couple more details. Even though it's called the Federal Reserve, it is neither federal nor does it have reserves. Like, it's not a federal institution. It's a private institution and again, this sounds like a conspiracy theory. Go look it up. It's a private institution, and nobody knows who the people sitting on the board of the Federal Reserve are. We know some of the front-facing representatives are, but it's a private institution that has profits. It has shareholders, and we don't know who they are.
What?
So you have this private company who's effectively shaping, I mean, every economic factor in life. It affects who's able to get loans, how much interest they're paying. it sounds crazy, but that's the reality of what they are and what they do.
That's crazy, man. All right. So that's good background. Okay. So now we've got, I feel like I've got a better understanding of the topic at hand, and that's how we're working our way to the talk of Bitcoin. So
yes,
for the listener, I'm going to try to articulate what I understand it to be. And sure. Then I'm going to have Jordan correct me and improvise off of it. So
let's do it.
With Bitcoin, what we've got is we've got a scarce resource that's being mined, and we're going to talk about that because I don't get it, mined and produced that you can buy and possess and trade that is not tied to the Federal Reserve. Is that a fair summary in some regards?
Yes, to quote our Zoomer brethren, facts. that's how it works. I will say this as well. So again, if you're a Christian and you're thinking about this and you're like, man, we're however long into this and we haven't even mentioned Bitcoin yet. Think of this like you do when you're sharing the gospel with somebody and you know, you spend, you know, a lot of people will spend 80% of the time trying to help people see that they're lost, in order to spend that 20% to understand the solution. You know, Jesus said, those who are well have no need of a physician. If you don't see the issue, you're not going to look for a change or look for difference. So that's kind of what, again, it sounds silly, but that's really kind of what we're, you know, when I have conversations with people, this is a totally normal thing to have happen. So Bitcoin is this scarce thing. It also helps, again, to kind of know where Bitcoin came from. So Bitcoin was created in the aftermath of the 2008 financial crisis. It was released on October 31st, 2008, which if that date should ring out to you, you know, you're thinking, oh, you know, great. This is, you know, I'm from, what is your church? Is it the Well Church? Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So from the Well, we're big Halloween people. We love it. No, as Christians, we are big Reformation Day people. And so, again, it's really interesting that the Bitcoin white paper, effectively the Bitcoin Declaration of Independence, goes live on Reformation Day.
That's fascinating.
And then the first Bitcoin that's mined is actually mined on January 3rd, which is the day that Luther was excommunicated from the Catholic Church. I'm not saying that has anything to do with each other, but it certainly is interesting. It is weird. So this thing was created. It was a long time coming, but Bitcoin was the product of, again, couple decades of people trying to work and trying to leverage cryptography, which is basically a way to conceal information, trying to use cryptography to make some type of digital currency that would be outside a private money supply, that would be outside of the influence of the Federal Reserve and these other, you know, institutions that are creating money. So Bitcoin ended up being created. And again, it was created because the creator, one of the things that he mentions is the way that the United States government was able to bail out these banking institutions that had literally been gambling with billions and billions of dollars of people's money. They'd been completely gambling with it. And then the United States government chose to turn around and bail them out and not send a single one of them to jail for the scams that they were running on people. While that happened, then all of the people, there were plenty of people who had gotten homes under conditions they shouldn't have, and they lost everything. And they had to deal with all of the consequences, and the bankers didn't have to deal with any of the consequences. So Bitcoin is created to be this independent, decentralized digital currency to operate in a at least a parallel outside of the existing system. So that's kind of where it comes from. You mentioned mining. Okay. So this sounds really weird. And you're like, how does this work? What in the world does this mean? So there's not little digital guys with, you know, pickaxe and shovels. Like, this isn't how this works. But the reason it's called mining is because of the dynamics and the similarities between what happens with Bitcoin and the way that new Bitcoin enters the world and supply as how new gold enters supply. So in order to create money, we mentioned this, the importance of sowing and reaping to govern money. Now, gold is money that requires sowing and reaping. If you're going to go get new gold, if you're a governing official and you have gold as your currency and you want to create more money, what you then have to do is pay guys to go dig it up out of the ground, refine it. You need to pay for them to have tools to be able to do all that. You have to, you know, pay to refine it. You have to go through this whole process. So the creation of money actually has a cost to it. And so with Bitcoin, it was created to operate the same way. Now, there are only two ways, there have only ever been two ways to get Bitcoin. The way that you do it is either to expend energy and resources and to buy computers, to pay for the electricity to operate those computers, to pay for a place to store those computers, or buy Bitcoin from somebody who's already done that process.
Okay.
So even though it's counterintuitive, there's actual real world resources being exchanged and involved in the you know, the issuance process of Bitcoin. Now you asked, what does that actually do? What are you actually paying to do? So this is where it gets a little specious. It sounds more, a little bit more suspicious or weird. So what these computers are doing, these are dedicated computers. You can't surf the internet. they don't have computer screens. They're just these little rectangular boxes. And what they're doing is they're using all of their effort to try to guess this, this very difficult, very high number. They're throwing all this computational power to try to guess this number that is locking up this block of Bitcoin. And so, you know, this process is called mining. It's also called hashing. So they're, again, literally just trying to guess this number, and they're expending tons of energy to try to be the one that guesses this number and unlocks an amount of Bitcoin. This amount of Bitcoin changes every 4 years. Every 4 years, the number of Bitcoin that gets issued every 10 minutes in a block of Bitcoin gets cut in half. So as of today, this morning, every 10 minutes on average, a new block of 6.125 Bitcoin is mined. Somewhere someone is mining, you know, they have these computers that are mining, and they get a reward for finding this block of Bitcoin, for being the computer to guess the correct number, and then Bitcoin gets issued to them. In the same way as if you're out there digging around in the ground and you find gold, that's your block reward. That's your reward for doing the work of digging. If you didn't do the digging, you wouldn't be able to find the reward. And so there's a sowing and a reaping between, you know, you being the one to find it and you being the one to get it.
Okay. This topic. So who is in charge of making the number that the computer is trying to guess?
Yes. So all of this is, again, if you're not a computer guy, like, this is going to kind of blow your mind and seem crazy.
Maybe
so,
that's why I get stuck, because I'm not really a computer guy.
100%. But so this is where some more of the, again, using the creation of the world as a way to kind of, it's a framework for this, is actually helpful. So the way that Bitcoin works is it was put on the internet as an open source project. This guy just said, anybody who wants to participate in this can open it. There was no pre-mine or, you know, no like rounding up the troops and saying, here, you guys, I'm going to give you some of this so that you go out and pump it to everyone. There's none of that. This is just when, hey, anybody wants to participate, if you're willing to expend computational power and pay for the energy to do so, you can participate. And so he goes out and he does this. And so this project, this is how it gets introduced to the world. I'm spacing on what your question was.
No, it's fine. The question is, because we've talked about the Federal Reserve, we talked about the central banks, and you're talking about these kind of shadowy figures that control currency and that kind of thing.
Yes,
And what you've described to me, because we just talked about that, and because this is, I think this is the issue I get hung up on, is I'm with you so far up to the point where there's some kind of rules. Like,
yes,
there's creational rules with gold. Like, I get that. You can go start a gold mine and refine. You can go conquer a people and get gold.
Let's go.
I don't understand who's controlling the Bitcoin, whatever you called it, block, or the computational numbers to where this computer is exerting energy in order to finally guess or discern the number. Who determines that number, or who has set the parameters for the release of new numbers to be discovered?
Right. So that number is baked into running Bitcoin. So when Satoshi Nakamoto is this figure who created Bitcoin, it's the pseudonymous figure. Nobody knows who he is or who they were, or, you know, anything on those lines. So he baked that into the code of Bitcoin. So when you play the game of Bitcoin, or when you operate by Bitcoin, those are just the rules that are built into it. You if you wanted to change those rules, okay, you can do what's called a fork. You can basically say, all right, I want a Bitcoin that works like this, but then you're starting a whole new thing. You're not doing you can't, basically you can't change these rules that have been set in stone. It's very similar to the laws of sowing and reaping. God created the world to operate by certain parameters, laws of thermodynamics, you know, broadly govern the world. Jesus, you know, can reign on those anytime he wants to, but like that's how the world works. God, you know, made the world to be governed by these things. Bitcoin is a very similar, in a very similar way. In the beginning, Satoshi said, let there be governing rules. And that's how it works. It's, you know, programmed into how it works, and you can't go back retroactively and undo those rules. For basically the reason why you can't go back is you'd have to undo transactions. Every transaction that's taken place over the last 15 years, which would require literally impossible amount of energy and all these things. Like it would literally be impossible to do that. So,
Is Bitcoin,
that's kind of how it works.
One, like when I hear about Ethereum or some other kind of cryptocurrency, is that a different thing than Bitcoin, or is that just a currency of Bitcoin?
So it's a completely different thing. And this is, so basically this is another challenge that people have in trying to think about these issues. When they think about cryptocurrencies, they think about them like they do stocks. And so they think, Bitcoin is Apple and Ethereum is Tesla and Dogecoin is, you know, in and out. You got this, amen. You got this framework for people thinking about. The issue is that stocks are not like money, or that money is not like stocks. Whereas, you know, stocks are these companies that exist within a world or within a country. Currencies trend towards one. And the reason for that is nobody wants to use in their day-to-day life multiple currencies. It's incredibly inefficient. As American citizens, we have the benefit where almost none of us need to think in multiple currencies. Who are the people who think in multiple currencies? They're people who live on borders. You know, if you live in South Texas or in, you know, up in upstate New York where I grew up, you know, you're right on the border with Canada and they use a different currency. You might have to think, you have to learn to operate in multiple currencies, but nobody wants to do that. Because you never know. There's this uncertainty of whether or not you're getting the best exchange rate for your currency. And so when it comes to the desirability or like a future facing focus of, all right, I've already missed the boat on Bitcoin. Bitcoin's $50,000 per coin. I'm going to try to go and you know, buy something like, you know, Doge that's a lot cheaper. The reality is that they're completely different things. They operate and are governed by completely different processes. And again, the specifics of them are very different as well. So there's effectively no cap on something like Ethereum. Has a governing board of a handful of people who could put a gun to their head and tell them, make these changes to Bitcoin, and they could go ahead and do it. And it would ripple all throughout the rest of the thing. It's actually incredibly, incredibly fragile in that way. In addition to that, Ethereum has had they've made all kinds of promises. We're going to do this by this date. And it's like 4, 5, 6 times they've had to like renege on that. And so whereas Bitcoin is governed by code and governed by energy and prevented from these large scale changes happening by the fact that it would require ridiculous, comical, all the energy of the world directing towards just Bitcoin mining. Like, in order for that to happen, Ethereum is just making changes to Ethereum and other projects like it. Almost every project is like Ethereum, is based like this. They're able to have these large scale changes. So the question you might be asking yourself is, well then why are there so many people who are, you know, buying into these other cryptocurrencies? Why are they doing that? What's the incentive model? The incentive model is that all these other cryptocurrencies, where you can just create them, their supply is not tied to energy. It can be created based on this governing board saying, all right, we want to create 200 million of these or 30, you know, 3 billion of these. It's a way for them to make themselves, in effect, central bankers who can create money out of thin air.
Okay.
So whereas Christians, we go, hey, we want scarce money that abides by the same rules that God made to govern the world. And we think that we trust God. He's decided that the world should function that way. We trust him. We're going to abide by it. These guys who are creating these cryptocurrencies go, our primary objection to central banking is not that it exists. It's that we're not on the central. We're not part of the Federal Reserve. We want to be on the Federal Reserve. And so we're going to make our own currencies so that we can, you know, have the same privileges.
Okay. That makes sense. So one hesitation I have with Bitcoin is that, you know, with gold, it's a tangible resource that I can hold in my hand. And what I hear a lot of Bitcoin guys talk about, or it seems to me, is I'm with them on all the stuff about, you know, getting away from central banks, all that kind of stuff.
Sure.
But I'm thinking even more radically, you might say, than that, where like, if let's say a global virus came out, and or let's say there was an attack on our power grid, and things went down, and all I have is digital currency on my phone, which is about to die because I can't power it. How is this a good resource to have that's durable into the future? Because gold, I can kind of make sense of, like, if things collapse into anarchy and chaos, gold is a thing that's in my safe, not currently. I don't have any, but, you know, theoretically, it's something I can have. Whereas crypto, I'm like, or like Bitcoin, I'm like, yeah, but it's still a digital thing. So, like, how does this help me in that kind of situation?
It's a fantastic question. So this is the reality is what I don't know anybody who's saying Bitcoin is this panacea that is perfect in every situation, no matter what, with full stop. Like nobody's saying that. But what we're looking at is we live in a world of trade-offs. We live in a world of multiple threat models. And so in the case that the internet gets taken down, like our money is going to be one of the lower things. I mean, it's going to be one of the things we care about, but I mean, hospitals, everyone will die. Like, I mean, our entire economy is based on, you know, based on the internet at this point. People are going to, I mean, it's going to be hellscape. It's going to be awful. So again, I, what I'm not saying is that people should only own Bitcoin, only forget, sell all of your lands, sell all of your everything else, sell all of your stocks and go buy Bitcoin. I'm not saying that at all. I think that would be insane. Because again, we are physical beings who have physical needs. And so again, I'm not even, I own gold. I'm not saying don't own gold. It's the gold bugs historically who don't like us. So I had this, there's, if you guys seen the meme, the Star Trek meme where it's the two guys next to each other. And then a girl says to them, are you two friends? And the one guy says yes. And the other one says no. The Bitcoiners are the ones who's like, we like gold. You know, we like gold people. And the gold bugs are like, no, we don't, no. We don't like them. So here's the other side of that equation. So if that's this particular threat model that we're talking about, then yeah, Bitcoin for at least a period of time is not going to be the most effective thing. We're in a world where you can send Bitcoin transactions over shortwave radio. You can do, there's different ways you can send Bitcoin transactions offline, but again, it still isn't ideal even today. At the same time, here's another threat model for you. So in the case of our Venezuelan brothers and sisters, you know, we live in a world where immigration is this huge issue. You have people who are being forced to, for economic reasons, for war reasons, whatever, they're having to flee certain countries and go to other countries. And so in the case of our Venezuelan brothers and sisters, when they're leaving their country, many of them, the vast majority of them, walked across the border. They didn't have enough money to fly out of Venezuela to Uruguay. They had to walk across the border. And so what that created is you have lots of geographical, like physical points at which people could rob them. And because there were people who, you know, knew that there were so many Venezuelans fleeing the country, there were people waiting to try to see who's got goods that we can rob. So in the case of Bitcoin, there's been numerous people who've done this. They can sell their Venezuelan currency and buy Bitcoin in Venezuela. They can have that Bitcoin. They can, you know, have it on an app on their phone, or you know, even it doesn't even need to be on an app on their phone. But they can memorize a 12-word seed phrase, a 12-word passphrase. They can delete that off their phone. They can do whatever. They can get to where they're going. They can plug in that 12-word passphrase, and they have access to all of their money again. And so that is a tremendously valuable thing for millions and millions of people all over the world. So again, it really does depend on the you know, the threat model that you're looking at. The other thing that I would say, you know, you may be saying to yourself, American people, you're like, well, we're not immigrants. You know, we don't need to worry about that. Well, if you're a Christian and you are faithful to the scriptures, you know, you're quickly approaching a point in which you could be, you know, debanked for your beliefs, you know, for obeying the Bible, being faithful to the scriptural teachings on, let's say, human sexuality. I had this conversation with Doug Wilson. I had, you know, Pastor Doug on my podcast, and I've been thinking about him in Bitcoin for a long time, because I when the Canadian trucker protest thing happened,
Yeah.
I was really excited. I felt bad for being excited, but I was very excited because I'd been literally praying for something like that, because it would be the perfect use case, perfect thing to demonstrate the use case for Bitcoin. And, you know, I've also got to interview BJ Dichter, who is the spokesperson for the protest, the Canadian protest. And he said, you know, Bitcoin, we were debanked, cut off from the rest of our bank accounts. The only money that we were able to access for a period of time was the Bitcoin that people donated. Huh. And it was censorship resistant. They couldn't just, you know, take that money from us. So there are use cases for normal US-based people, and specifically Christians, you know, churches. I mean, imagine, this is, again, the argument that I made to him was, Pastor Doug, what are you going to do if tomorrow you preach a sermon about transgenderism, you say something insane like boys can't become girls by chopping off their penises, and Wells Fargo just cuts you guys off?
Right.
In the long term, you can file court cases, and court cases have been a bastion of sanity largely. But that takes 2 or 3 years for that, right, kind of stuff to go through. How are you going to pay salary in the meantime? And so I look at Bitcoin as one tool in the tool belt that, okay, can help mitigate and provide a way out for some of these other threat models that actually are more real present dangers.
Okay, great. I know we're going long, but I'm going to keep asking questions if you've got time, because
good.
Like,
I'm good.
Okay, so I get that, because our church was debanked a couple of years ago from US Bank. I don't believe it was because of anything we necessarily said. I think it was mainly because there were certain requirements with US banking that nonprofits disclose donor lists, and we said no.
Wow.
And then we woke up one day and they had issued us a check with all of our money, and we were like, well, this isn't going to work.
<You know? laughs> So yeah, that's a bummer.
We got it resolved within a couple of a few weeks. We got on the phone and got it open. We since moved on from them because we don't ever want that to happen again. But it's a very compelling case to own Bitcoin. One of the questions that I have with Bitcoin is, because you can mine it, I would be, obviously you can go out and you can buy either a piece of Bitcoin or a whole, like, how much is one Bitcoin worth today?
Yeah. So one Bitcoin is worth $50,000, like $52,000 at this point. But again, as you mentioned, I can buy a penny's worth of Bitcoin. I can buy a dollar's worth of Bitcoin. So there's no requirement that you buy a whole one in order to have access.
Okay.
To it.
So somebody like me that's late to the game, and I like the idea of owning a whole Bitcoin, and I do not have that amount of US dollars to buy a Bitcoin, and then you tell me that I can go mine it. Well, I'm like, well, I'd like to do that. What do I need to do to make that happen? How do I mine? Like, can I go to Best Buy and pick up a computer today and go mine Bitcoin? What does that look like?
Not yet. That day is coming. But what you can do. So here's the thing. What Bitcoin does is it allows you to turn electricity or energy sources into money. Okay, this is what it allows you to do. So there's a number of ways you can buy these mining computers. I'm happy to like give a link if people are interested. But the key is, if you want to make money with Bitcoin, you need to find cheap energy sources. Okay, now there are people who have things like solar, you know, like they have cheap solar energy. They have lots of sun, and so they can set out solar panels and use that energy to mine Bitcoin. I have friends who do that. Another thing, though, is, especially if you live in a cold place, you live in a place where it's cold. I know people who, they have a good number of people and a growing number of people who, they plug in Bitcoin mining computers in their basements. They connect those Bitcoin miners to their duct system, their air duct system, and they use Bitcoin, the heat produced by these Bitcoin mining computers, to heat their homes in the winter.
That is funny.
And so, these things exist. It's still niche at this point because Bitcoin's niche, but these are things that you can do. So that would be one way to do it. Again, the difficulty for the average person trying to mine Bitcoin is that most of us don't have access to cheap enough power at current Bitcoin price levels to make it valuable.
Because you're pulling off the power grid, right? I mean, you're pulling electricity.
Yes. Okay. Yes, exactly. So unless now, and again, this is another thing that might apply to certain people. One of the things that Bitcoin is doing is it's fixing the incentives of the energy industry, and it's fixing the energy industry more broadly. So here's an example. What part of Texas are you from?
Dallas.
Okay, Dallas. All right. So in Texas, obviously, humongous energy producing state. despite that, tons of oil and gas, tons of, you know, all these things, they've had rolling blackouts in different parts of Texas the last couple of years. Now, that is insane. Why is that happening if they have so much electricity? Well, Texas has invested heavily in what is called renewable energy, which I want to burn into the minds of every person who listens to this. Whenever you hear renewable, think unreliable energy sources. All right. Repeat after me. Unreliable energy sources. And so what that means is wind and solar. So if the sun isn't shining, you're not getting power. If the wind isn't blowing, you're not getting power. And so what happens is because they've invested so heavily in these things and made it such a large percentage of their, of the mix of the things that power their state and provide power to their people, when those things fail or when they don't have those things, they have shortfalls.
Yeah.
One of the ways in which Bitcoin is fixing this is there are tons of Bitcoin mining companies that are moving into Texas. And they're setting up these, you know, places where they have the, you know, that's by a large amount of Bitcoin, of natural gas or oil wells that are largely, there's some that are, you know, some that are just built into the normal, they're normal size energy producers. There's other ones where they're these abandoned or stranded wells. They don't have enough supply to just be flowing all the time into normal people's lives. But there's still enough there. There's still stuff there. So what these guys do is they pull up a shipping container that has, you know, 100 Bitcoin miners or a few hundred or a few thousand Bitcoin miners in them. They cap the either the natural gas or the oil well to a generator, and then they use that energy to mine Bitcoin with. And okay. So then they're monetizing this wasted stranded resource that they then can use to fund development of their infrastructure or whatever they want to. The other thing that they can do is they have, you know, the ones that are larger scale that are connected to the grid. They're using this energy. The Bitcoin companies sign contracts with them. They'll say, hey, we're going to use X amount of electricity 24/7, 365. That gives these electrical companies the ability to plan, and they know, all right, we can factor this into our economic calculation, to our, you know, our planning calculation. And in the event that we arrive at a shortfall, like has been happening, we will shut down all of our Bitcoin miners and send all of that power back to the grid to help overcome these weaknesses. And so the ways that, like, literally Bitcoin has saved the grid in Texas the last couple of years by, you know, by providing them this electricity right when they needed it. And that build out and development in Texas and in other places around the country and around the world is happening more and more.
Okay. One question I have on then the mining, going back to it a little bit, is when, like, how much is the cost entry for one computer to buy? Obviously you've got fixed costs with electricity and demand on that kind of thing. So, like, if you do it, it's a huge gamble, it seems like to me. Like, if I were to tell my wife, hey, I'm going to buy this computer and we're going to get a Bitcoin, and then our, like, electric bill's insane. I don't know how long it takes to mine one Bitcoin. And then two, what does that computer cost?
Yeah. So again, it really depends on, so the computers themselves are different. There's different Bitcoin miners that have different levels of power. So, where is it? I've got like a little tiny Bitcoin miner that sits on my desk and, like, it's officially mining Bitcoin, but I'm never going to make any kind of money. Like, it's just for show. Sure. It's actually mining, but it's just never going to make enough money. Then there are, there's ones that, again, some of the ones that my buddy is using to heat his house, that can be, as cheap as a couple $100. Like, it's nothing crazy, but you're not going to mine as much Bitcoin with that. It's not as powerful. I also have in my garage, a Bitcoin miner that costs about $1,600. And that is, it's powerful enough to actually make a good amount of money within a decent amount of time, depending on your energy cost. So that's one of the things. So you can buy a Bitcoin miner to mine it. You can also buy Bitcoin miners as speculative assets themselves. Okay. And so this brings me to one of my greatest regrets in Bitcoin. I have several, but one of them is, I had in, I believe it was 2019. Again, I'm a missionary. I have very little extra money, and I'm sitting there. I see Bitcoin. I have $2,500. I think I got my tax return or something. And I'm like, okay, I have $2,500. I can either buy this Bitcoin mining computer, or I can buy $2,500 worth of Bitcoin. Okay. I don't have cheap electricity here with me. I'd have to send it to like a third party. This is another thing you can do is you can send your computers, buy them through a company. They'll mine on site for you. And then you can try to do it that way. I was like, that's going to be complicated. I'll just buy the Bitcoin. So I bought the $2,500 worth of Bitcoin. Within 2 months, the cost of Bitcoin miners, because the price of Bitcoin went up so quickly, there was a huge spike in demand for these miners. The cost of that Bitcoin miner for a few months went to $20,000.
Jeez.
And so I was like, oh, why? And so again, that's another thing that people do is, they'll do arbitrage with the miners themselves if they think that the price is going to go up, because it'll create this demand spike. So there's a few different ways you can do it. For most people, though, what I would recommend is just buying Bitcoin. It's not sexy. It's just buying it just like a little bit every month or, a little bit every week. It's the process is called like DCAing, Bitcoin is this, it's this just monetary system that's disguised as a get rich quick scheme. Like,
sure.
It's not like there are people who do get rich quick, but that's not why it was created. That's not how it works. And if that's why you go into it, if you go into it thinking you're going to do that, you will get wrecked. Like, okay. I know so many people who try to do that to get rich quick and you get wrecked. But if you're trying to invest in like a scarce thing that, will go up over time just based on, just the adoption curve alone. Like the market for Bitcoin, the people who have access to internet who can use Bitcoin is 4 billion people. As of today, like 400,000 people or 500,000 people own any Bitcoin. So the market for Bitcoin is huge. The amount of people who have incentive and the ability to buy it is enormous. And even though it's been around for 15 years, we've heard about it and we feel like we're late. We're not late. Like you're okay. Not remotely late given the size of the market involved.
Okay. So then where does one buy Bitcoin?
Yeah. Yep. So again, there's a number of places. The thing I would say is there's a site called river.com. This is who I would recommend people work with. They only sell Bitcoin. Why does that matter? So many people are familiar with something called Coinbase. They've done Super Bowl ads or, they're this big, probably the most well-known Bitcoin exchange. They sell probably 10,000 different cryptocurrencies. Now, why do they do that? Because they make a 1.5% to 2% spread. They get paid that. They take that as a fee on every trade they make. So even though they don't believe in any of those hardly any of those currencies, they're willing to sell them because, hey, who are we to decide to tell people, no, they can't buy this.
Sure.
River only sells Bitcoin. And in so doing, in the short term, they're leaving millions of dollars on the table by refusing to sell something that they don't believe in. So
yeah.
They're somebody I believe in. There's other companies that are like that. There's a company called Swan that does the same thing.
Okay.
I can give you a link, there, again, you can just go out to those companies independently. We have like a referral link for Thank God for Bitcoin where, it helps them see that we're bringing people to them if people care, but again, no.
Okay, cool. I'll try to put that in the show notes. Yep. Two more and then I'm going to let you go.
Because
I think we could keep talking for hours on this. One is the mining computers. It sounds like you're telling me that these mining computers can mine kind of like until they crap out as computers. Yeah. It's not like they shut down after they accomplish one thing. Do they mine only for a full Bitcoin, or do they mine partial coins or pennies?
No, you're
or whatever?
Mining. Yeah. So Bitcoin, one Bitcoin is composed of like 100 million fractions that are called Satoshis. And so, yeah, you're just mining Satoshis the whole time. You don't have to wait to get to one Bitcoin. So it's as much Bitcoin as you're able to mine, they will, it just gets sent to you.
Okay, cool. And then one of the biggest things as a business owner, cause we own a business too, is, taxes. Taxes have been, I'm a millennial. I grew up in the crash. I was sympathetic to the whatever the movement was that was like kind of hippie, it wasn't tax the rich. It was like, the 99%, that kind of thing was starting out.
What's that thing called? Something Wall Street.
Occupy
Wall Street. There you go.
Yeah. I never like got into it. In fact, I dressed as one of them for Halloween because I thought it was silly. But there was a sympathy I had because they were calling out something that was a real problem in my mind.
100%.
And then we become a business owner and now we're getting taxed for anything we make, left and right, all the time, just like constantly, especially in a progressive, more progressive state like Colorado, they're always trying to introduce new taxes.
Yep.
And so my question for Bitcoin would be, do I get taxed on Bitcoin? Because I would like to stop with the whole like relationship I have with paying taxes, because it's killing us. Like it, if you have 1 year where you make a lot of profit and you have another year where the market does a downturn, but you're responsible for paying last year's taxes on last year's profit, but you're planning to use that capital to invest in your business this year, you're screwed. Like you're, I don't, this 100%. Is insane to me. And so
it is. Yeah.
That's why I'm wondering about Bitcoin with taxes, because it's a very, like, to me, it's a huge problem. And owning a business kind of makes you conservative fiscally. I don't know how you own a business and can be, you know, and anyway, so can you get taxed on Bitcoin?
Yeah. So the same thing is true of kids, right? When you have kids, you become conservative. So when you have assets, you become conservative because you realize the work that they take to the work that goes into having them. So as it relates to Bitcoin, there's a couple things there. So the first question, I'll directly answer your question, which is you don't pay taxes on Bitcoin until you sell Bitcoin.
Okay.
So if you're, so in your case as a business owner, and this is what I would recommend more and more people do, is offer your customers, if you, it's something you want to do, you want to accumulate Bitcoin, offer your customers the option of paying you in Bitcoin. Now, again, you're sitting there like, well, how many people are really going to want to do that? I don't know, because given where you're at, I do know that Bitcoiners are raving psychopaths who the one thing that will get them to part with their Bitcoin is when other businesses accept Bitcoin.
Okay.
So like I am happy to pump the living daylights out of any business that will accept Bitcoin. I've got a buddy who's got a woodworking business. He made the desk that I'm sitting at right now, the you know, desktop that I'm sitting at. And so I just sent him out, and he's, you know, got people who have eyeballs on him, who are interested in it just by virtue of him offering to accept Bitcoin as payment. So that's a way that you are accumulating Bitcoin. You're not having to buy it by virtue of getting paid in it. Again, we're not trying to avoid the government, but like the government, this is stuff that's not directly tied to you, tied to your bank account and whatever that you've purchased this. Again, as it relates to paying taxes, you're only paying taxes when you sell. And so in today's environment, if you are to buy Bitcoin and, you know, you do need to sell some, to pay taxes or whatever, then it's going to be the amount of the increase, you're going to pay taxes on the increase. You're not just going to pay taxes on the Bitcoin itself. Any amount that the Bitcoin is increased in dollar terms, you'd have to pay taxes on that. But again, so this is why for most people, a lot of people, especially if this is kind of your introduction, you should not just be buying Bitcoin just for fun or like, hey, I'm going to hang in this for a few days. I'm going to try to swing trade Bitcoin.
Yeah, right.
That is a tremendous way to get absolutely wrecked. Bitcoin is not for swing trading. It will just, the moves are too big, both to the upside and to the downside. For the average person, it's just going to get you destroyed. The way that when I talk to people, you should think about Bitcoin as part of your long-term saving strategy. That's the way to benefit and mitigate the risk involved with the volatility of it. Bitcoin is super volatile. Over the long term, it's volatile to the upside. It goes like this. It keeps going all up over time because of a number of factors, including the adoption curve. But it's not something where you should be trying to hop in and out and play the game. You're going to get killed. But just if as part of your long-term savings, you can do that. Again, that's kind of the way to for the norm, for the average person to make Bitcoin, you know, work for them.
Okay. This was great. I may DM you some more questions, because
let's go.
I think for the average listener, I've got lots of guys that are friends with me that they probably won't even listen to this, because these questions to them are like, so like, oh, Chase, you're an idiot. But to me, like, this has been incredibly helpful and enlightening. So Jordan, just thank you for your time. I mean, I did not receive Bitcoin in exchange for this interview. You're welcome to send some my way. This was just me
I'll
learning.
See what I can do.
So so hopefully you listener enjoyed this episode. Jordan, thank you for spending time with me. Where can, what's the website again? Thankgodforbitcoin.com. Where can people go?
Yeah, TGFB.com. The one thing I would mention, you can find me on Twitter. I'm sure Chase, if that's where you're finding this, you'll be able to find me in there.
Yeah.
The thing that I would say is that we do TGFB. We do one big conference event per year. And so this year it's going to be July 24th and 25th in Nashville. We're going to be at Rocket Town. The thing, Michael W. Smith, all of our, friends are friends forever. If you're familiar with him. So we're going to be there. And again, we're going to have a bunch of speakers. Again, when you hear Thank God for Bitcoin, you're thinking one thing. You're thinking, oh, they're going to have Joel Osteen speak. No, we're actually going to have C.R. Wiley speaking. He spoke last year. C.R. is going to come back. Ben Merkel is coming to speak. Pastor Thomas Terry, part of Beautiful Eulogy, if you guys are familiar with him, he's going to come speak. And there's a number of other people, other names that we're in conversation with to come speak. So again, we'd love to have you if you guys want to come hang out in Nashville for a weekend. It's going to be a good time.
Excellent. Well, Jordan, thanks so much for your time today.
I appreciate you. Excellent.